Hi, this is Megan McHugh, and this is the podcast of Triple R Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy, and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia, every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.
G'day. Thanks to Vanessa from Banksia and welcome aboard the Starship Zero G, science fiction, fantasy and historical radio for episode number 1580, entitled The Games Afoot of a Giant Rat of Sumatra. And our podcast title is The Adventure of the Unpodded Adventures. I'm Rob Jan.
And Megan McHugh.
And we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land of the Wurundjeri on which we gather today and broadcast from and to. We would also like to pay our respects to the elders past, present and future. So, it's been 139 years since I first started reading Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories. Doyle wrote 56 short stories and four novels up to 1927. Of course, there have been a vast number of adaptations of the 60 of those stories for the stage in both large and small screen. And in print, there is a Brobdingnagian array of pastiches written by other authors, expanding upon every possible aspect of the great detective and the Shirley-verse. And then there are the honourable mentions, that is, Sherlock Holmes's cases cited within the canonical 60, often as a point of comparison to the mystery in hand, but not further explored by Doyle. For example, the giant rat of Sumatra mentioned in the Adventure of the Sussex Vampire, which incidentally has nothing to do with an actual vampire. It's like a typical Scooby-Doo of the Baskervilles. So there are about 69 of these intriguing unpublished cases in all, which have, of course, fans being fans themselves, been explored by many a Sherlockian ever since. Enter this year's Melbourne Comedy Festival and a show titled Holmes Unbound, The Lost Casebook of Sherlock Holmes, which is on at the Improv Theatre at 21 to 23 Stanley Street in West Melbourne. The shows are running from the Tuesday the 31st of March to Sunday the 5th of April. So, no mystery at least to long-term Zero-G listeners that this is brought to us by those masters of investigative fan adventures, Innes Lloyd, which is to say David Innes and Rob Lloyd and their merry ensemble of players. And we have in the studio, welcome aboard again, Rob Lloyd.
It is an absolute pleasure to be back for my 97th appearance, I believe, on Zero-G.
And they still don't know what you look like.
And as, you know, as Holmes says, I'm lost without my Boswell. I am me, Rob Lloyd, am lost without my Jan.
I thought that would have been David Innes, actually. But I'll take that.
We won't tell him.
Okay, so you'd include the giant rat of Sumatra in your show. It's a no-brainer, particularly since it's already been made beloved by Doctor Who.
Yes. Come on.
I see the middle of the Venn diagram coming together. Okay.
Yes. It's no longer two separate. It is clearly
the
one.
The two of you together, I see what's happened here. Yeah.
In which Tom Baker serial?
That is The Talons of Weng Chiang.
Mm. In which the Doctor dressed like and pretty much functioned like a Sherlock Holmes surrogate. Because, of course, Tom Baker did play Sherlock Holmes.
For one interpretation of The Hound of the Baskervilles. Mm. Yes. Mm. It wasn't a very remarkable interpretation. His Watson was very much like Nigel Bruce in the way of very bodily and quite ridiculous. The Hound wasn't that well realised. It was very, you know, early 80s BBC television. So the costumes were sumptuous, but it was like shot quite small scale.
What did they call that special effect they used to use? Chroma key.
Chroma key.
Yeah.
Mr. Barry Letts loved a good bit of chroma key.
So the question of the moment, is there a giant rat puppet in your production?
Yes. Yes, there is. Oh, my gosh. Why, we are so happy to have our wonderful Donna Prince, who did all our puppetry work with the Ghostlight League for Shakespeare Aliens, Shakespeare Ghostbusters. She is back. We have enlisted her to help us create the giant rat of Sumatra. I'm going to bury the lead, Rob. Yes, we have a giant rat puppet. It's awesome.
Well, the bar actually is pretty low from the Doctor Who production.
Look, there's an endearing quality to that giant, almost Mickey Mouse-esque fuzzy thing. And Louise Jamison had to do her best acting ever to be screaming and wailing being grabbed by that large rat.
Oh, you just met Louise Jamison again. She was in Melbourne. She played Leela in Doctor Who, of course, in Tom Baker era.
And she was in The Talents of Wen Chiang. Yes. She was out here and she did a wonderful show called Shakespeare's Mistress the night before the convention. I went to that over at the Pride of Footscray, wonderful venue. And she talked about her time being an actor and all her work in television and then her, you know, interspersed with her doing Shakespearean monologues.
Mm. Wow. So, yeah. Wow. So that's right up your alley. Really.
Right up my alley. Yep. One Shakespeare fool watching a Shakespeare mistress. I was in hog's heaven.
Yeah. Do you know, I was yesterday years old when I found out that Shakespeare had actually used Joan of Arc in one of his stories.
I am as well.
Yeah, yeah. It's like it's Henry the Fourth, I think, part one.
One of those ones. Yeah,
one of those ones, which were kind of less.
Yeah, and the two-parter Henry the Fourth one is always, or three-parters even in some ways.
I was thinking Joan of Arc because of Louise Jamison's Leela, you know, another Amazonian strong woman.
Exactly.
Okay, look, you could do this production straight. Where have you found the comedy in adapting Sherlock Holmes?
Well, I love the fact when I get to write with Innes, we understand each other's sense of humours and what makes us laugh, and we've been a success, and I do that in inverted commas, because we find other people who laugh at what we find funny. So I like the structure of it because I get to be Sherlock Holmes, which is amazing, and I'm kind of like the Nicholas Angel if I'm going to do a Hot Fuzz reference. Mm. So Simon Pegg played the lead character in Hot Fuzz, awesome cop comedy buddy drama, and he played it completely straight, but everyone else around him would be ridiculous. Mm. So Innes and I are kind of playing the straights as we have all the ridiculousness around us and doing our unique interpretation of characters who have been interpreted for over 100 years.
Like a Michael Caine in the Muppet Christmas type of situation.
Exactly. The best way to work against a Muppet or an Innes Lloyd performer is to do it completely straight.
Speaking of the other people in it, there appear to be street urchins.
We do have the wonderful Liliana Bramberger and Chloe Towan, amazing independent theatre performers. Chloe has, of course, created Scary Goats Theatre, who do their Twist of Fate series of shows, which are inspired by The Twilight Zone. Liliana Bramberger has just recently seen in David Innes's How Delightful production of Bevan Mert, which has been here to be talked about on Zero G. And they are playing the Baker Street Irregulars, who have been represented occasionally within the films and the TV show. Those salt of the earth, rough as guts, but they've got a heart of gold urchins who come in and help Holmes and Watson occasionally.
But clearly, since they are the Baker Street Irregular, they are lacking in moral fibre.
Well, they're lacking in airs and graces, but what they lack in the way of diplomacy and etiquette, they make up for with hearts of gold.
And I'm sure Cockney accents.
Cockney accents, yes, and they're also playing. Lil and Chloe are playing. We've got Lestrade, we've got Gregson, we've got Algar. All these obscure references, deep and thorough, playing multiple characters as well.
Most listeners will be familiar with long-suffering Inspector Lestrade from Scotland Yard, and the other two, Gregson is another inspector as well, but slightly bit quicker-witted.
Yes. Gregson makes his appearance in the first ever story, The Study in Scarlet. Mm. A Study in Scarlet. So we wanted to bring a range of the detectives and show how differently they interact with Holmes and Watson.
Mm. So how many other unpublished cases within your production are you adapting and why?
Well, in this one we're doing three, and the great thing was we came up with about 10 that we could do, and so we've got backup. So if this is a success, if we have a lot of fun with it, if people enjoy it, this is something that could be a potential Holmes Unbound franchise. Mm. We've just come off our Mina Harker franchise, which we've been doing over the last couple of years. So we whittled it down to the three that excited us the most, not just the titles, but the potential for a range of different shows. Because this is the first for us, we're doing three mini adventures mm-hmm. in one show.
Yeah.
So the title, Rigoletti of the Clubfoot and His Abominable Wife, we could not
pass that one.
Colonel Warburton's Madness was particularly inspired in us with his idea for a story, and Giant Rat of Sumatra, mm. it's Money in the Bank.
I was surprised to find out there actually is a giant mountain rat of Sunda. So there actually is some kind of
source material rat. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not just all pure fantasy. And no. Apparently there are vampires in Sussex.
Oh, I'm sure there are.
But that's a certain club you have to go to with a special password to get in.
Yeah, and no one will vouch for me. So.
Next time.
Are there any fantasy or science fiction elements in these? Because obviously that's something that you've worked with a lot.
Yeah, well, what we wanted to do with this was sort of like have a reference to all the range of different interpretations, because you go from the Robert Downey Jr. version, which is so action-based. Mm. You have the Hammer horror film, which goes into the supernatural and especially into the occult and the dark, gritty, sexualizing.
Is that the Christopher Lee one?
Christopher Lee as Lord Holmes. Baskerville Peter Cushing as the great Sherlock Holmes. So there's been multiple different versions. You can do it pure as The Driven Snow, like our dear Jeremy Brett series, which is like the definitive. You can be a bit more fantastical, like with Robert Downey Jr., or modernize it and make it hip and cool with Sherlock fighting Nazis with the Basil Rathbone series.
Oh, yes.
So
just on the Basil Rathbone one, because he, of course, was the definitive screen Holmes for his time.
Yes.
And the very first story that they adapted, Nigel Bruce was playing a more intelligent Watson, and then they just dumbed it down. Mm. I really miss that smart Watty.
Well, and he jumped eras as well. His first two. So the first one was an adaptation of Hound of the Baskervilles in 1939, and then that was so successful they did The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, which is like an independent original story. And after those two, which were period-based, they went, okay, let's go for it. They made cheaper versions of them and they modernized them so they had, you know, cars and trying to stop Nazis, spies invading America and all that type of stuff.
Yes, quick Holmes to the telephone.
Yeah.
Last week we reviewed Young Sherlock.
Yes.
The new Guy Ritchie one.
Mm. Right.
Have you checked that out yet?
I have not.
I've been too busy doing Sherlock.
We'll accept that.
And a lot of people have said, you know, it's not very Sherlock Holmes, but it's very, very good.
Yeah, yeah. It is actually fun.
Yeah.
We've seen so many different adaptations. I mean, obviously the Jeremy Brett ones are probably the closest on screen to the actual canonical stories. But that said, and that said, we've got this great amount of fun to be had in all of these other interpretations.
So much scope for the characters are what you latch onto, and that that idea of someone who is so clinical in their thoughts and what cases they can solve. You can throw any number of cases. Like Arthur Conan Doyle was kind of set in his ways of what type of adventures he'd like to do. He'd much rather be writing westerns. That was his real main love.
Westerns?
Yeah. A Study in Scarlet, the first half is, you know, foggy London Victorian era. And he goes, what I want to do? I want to go to the Wild West.
And he does too, doesn't he? He goes off to the Valley of Fear?
Yes.
Yeah.
He loves a good bit of western stuff in there.
His medieval stories better than that, or his Brigadier Gerard stories about the Napoleonic French cavalryman.
That's right. Mm. Yes.
He preferred those.
And he also
obviously, the rest of the world didn't.
Yes, he had his desires and he was driven back with his ambivalent thoughts.
Speaking of driving back, we're going away from Rob's production.
It wouldn't be a zero-G appearance if we didn't take the long way round.
Hey, speaking of Jeremy Brett, we'll play the opening theme of any number of the assorted volumes of Sherlock Holmes' casebooks that he interpreted back in the day, in the 80s basically, so 90s, 80s.
like especially in the 70s and the 80s, there were so many versions of it. So you had Tom Baker, you had Christopher Plummer, you had my personal favourite Sherlock Holmes, who only did two films just before Jeremy Brett, was Ian Richardson, who did Sign and Four and Hounds of the Baskervilles. And they were meant to do a third one, but they had issues with the rights. And then Jeremy Brett, of course, and then it just carried on. So many different interpretations from all around the world.
Even mice have played Sherlock Holmes.
It's a wonderful version. It's during the dark era of Disney, and that's my favourite era. So Basil the Great Mouse Detective is actually a really solid home story.
You and the Black Cauldron.
I love the Black Cauldron.
Yeah.
I like the Black Hole.
Yeah.
I like Watcher in the Woods. Something Wicked This Way Comes.
That's an excellent story. And the soundtrack for Something Wicked This Way Comes, I think, might have been done by James Horner.
Yeah.
Who we'll talk about later in the show.
Love that.
All right, let's get to the track.
Let's hear a little bit of the
We'll get
the
on
music.
Our Victorian segue and
ride into the Penny Farthing Sunset. Yes.
Hello, I'm Ray Harryhausen, animation pioneer. You're listening to Zero G on 3RRR FM.
Yeah, Jeremy Brett, the theme there for the television show with what a lot of people would think the definitive screen version of Sherlock Holmes there. And we are here talking with Rob Lloyd from Holmes Unbound, the lost casebook of Sherlock Holmes, a production at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival coming up on the 31st of March and going through to April the 9th at the Impro Melbourne Theatre, 9
April
p.m.
the 5th.
April 5th,
we're only doing six shows.
Yes, 9 p.m. at the Impro Theatre, which is in West Melbourne.
Yes, the Impro Melbourne Theatre, wonderful little hub they've created there. They've got improvised Jane Austen and they've got Shakespeare Unscripted. They've got some great shows up there for the whole festival, as well as Innes Lloyd doing their own version of Sherlock Holmes.
Just played a track with Jeremy Brett as Holmes, and I remembered that he'd actually played Watson on stage once with, and you'll never guess who his Holmes was. But Rob knows.
Charlton Heston.
Yeah.
Oh.
In The Crucible of Blood. He played it on Broadway.
Okay.
It's just gobstopping to think of how that would have played out.
made a movie of it as well, but not with Jeremy Brett as Watson. I can't remember who did it, but they made a movie with Charlton Heston as Sherlock Holmes. And that was one hill I would not climb on.
Oh, my God. I can remember, actually, just speaking of adaptations, because I was just wandering around on the internet, which is always a bad thing, before the show, and they were talking about a Japanese version of Sherlock Holmes where Holmes and Watson are women. It's set in contemporary Japan, and it looked hellacious. I haven't been able to track down an actual copy of it yet. But
so many different versions. There's a Sherlock Hound. There's, I think, any number of animated versions, live-action versions.
Yeah.
Other countries have done it. There's French, Russian, German versions.
Robbie the Robot has played Sherlock Holmes at one stage.
With a deerstalker on his head.
Yeah, a very big deerstalker.
Of course.
So, you know, we reviewed last week the latest pastiche of Sherlock Holmes, Young Sherlock, on telly. If I had to ask you, Rob, what your favourite non-Doyle pastiche was in print or performance? So I'm talking non-Doyle pastiche. So
Non-Doyle-based.
Not the canon stuff.
Oh, I'm glad.
Non-Doyle-based. New, less Doyle-y.
I am a big fan of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother.
Oh, yes.
By Gene Wilder. And also Without a Clue, I think, is one of my favourites.
Oh, with Ben Kingsley?
Ben Kingsley as Watson and Michael Caine as a drunk actor who's hired to play the personification of Sherlock Holmes.
Fun.
Because in this alternate reality, Ben Kingsley as Dr. Watson is the smart one. He solves all the crimes, but he doesn't want to go into that because it could ruin his reputation as a physician.
Actually, that's almost the identical plot to the Mandarin in Iron Man. he's typecast, poor old Ben. So, okay, there's a lot to be said to doing adapting Sherlock Holmes, and it's not quite like adapting Shakespeare because you don't have as much as many soliloquies and texts to guide you through the dialogue. Where are you coming up with the dialogue from?
The great thing, there is a great repartee between Holmes and Watson. And that's one thing that Doyle could do incredibly well, how this is why these characters have endured, is because no matter how small the adventures, a lot of his short stories were just sometimes set in just Baker Street. Mm-hmm. But because how the characters interact and talk and how that can be interpreted in multiple different ways, whether it's, you know, Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr. interpretation, or David Burke, my favorite, and Jeremy Brett. Mm. You have this range of how these characters interact and how these, you know, male-presenting characters develop a friendship and a connection and a relationship. And you can go as far or as reserved as you want. So dialogue is a great fun thing to do, because you can look at the text that is provided and you find a way of matching that in some ways. Mm-hmm. You can do improvised Shakespeare quite easily. It's a bit trickier to get improvised Holmes, because you have to get in that mind space of how he sees the world and how he categorizes what's important and what his knowledge is about particular things, whether it's the ash of a cigarette or it's the size of a shoe that in a footprint. And he can decipher from that footprint what type of shoe it is and all that type of stuff. So that's the fun thing of exploring how to make the characters believable by not, because what we didn't want to do is make them ridiculous, especially there's been so many ridiculous versions of Watson. We wanted Watson to have an element of respect and truth and an equal to Holmes in some ways. And so that was fun to explore, to find the comedy of how we interact as opposed to, you know, a comedic representation of the character.
Yeah, less of a sidekick sort of, and more of an ensemble kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, because the parody has been done before and not very well. If anyone's seen the Will Ferrell, film. Yeah,
I thought Martin Freeman's performance as Watson was very nuanced and it's kind of spot on.
He's a very good one. Another very good Watson is Ian Hart. Ian Hart, a great actor, played him in A Hound of the Baskervilles against Richard Roxburgh as Holmes, who wasn't very good, but Ian Hart was a very good Holmes.
And who's the one in the Elementary series? Is that Lucy Liu?
Lucy Liu. Yeah. A very good Watson.
Yeah. All right, so you're doing a Holmes production. Now, you've done a lot of Shakespeare productions, Shakespeare Aliens and Shakespeare Ghostbusters. And as a buff of the Bard, you obviously know that the iambic, and have had real experience with this, the iambic pentameter makes it easier to remember Shakespeare, to memorize the lines. Is there anything similar with Doyle's sort of dialogue in of Holmes?
The phrases can stick in your head, but there's such a specificity to the wording and the phrasing. It is a bit tricky to get the mind working to memorize that.
To get the little grey cells.
as I can attest, we're a week out from opening and, and trying to get some of the passages that we've written for ourselves, and they're going, oh, does he have to be so smart, though? Because maybe he could lose his memory. Or does everything in mime? That'll be a challenging way to push through any cliches of Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes and the Adventure of the Interpretative Dance.
The Abominable Interpretative Dance. That's how we do it.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, we've got Rob Lloyd in here today from the production of Holmes Unbound, The Lost Casebook of Sherlock Holmes, which is on at the Impro Melbourne Theatre at 21 to 23 Stanley Street in West Melbourne, running from Tuesday the 31st of March to Sunday the 5th of April at 9 p.m. Is that also the same on Sunday, or is there a matinee as well?
No, it's all 9 p.m. across the board. If you're coming on Sunday for closing night, have a late night. And then it's Easter Monday on the Monday, so any leftover chocolate if you... Yeah. Celebrate chocolate on that time.
I noticed, because it's not enough for you to do one show, you're also working with David Innes on another production.
Yes, very exciting. David Innes is bringing back to the Melbourne stage Grain of Truth, his podcast live panel show that he hasn't done for a number of years. And he's got it out of the cupboard, dusted it off, and brought back some of the old favourite regulars and got some exciting special guest stars coming along. So he'll be doing every weekend of the festival, Saturday and Sundays at about 3 p.m. in the afternoon at the Motley Bauhaus. And it's think QI, think have I haven't a clue, all those type of wonderful.
I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. There's showing your age.
Yeah.
My word.
Billy Rustin, live forever. It's a great fun show. First show is next Saturday. Mm-hmm. Purchase your tickets. Go along and see some of the best and brightest of the festival talking about things that they know. Because the show, yes, Grain of Truth, is all about celebrating the facts and celebrating the joy. And in a world post-truth, isn't it good to celebrate?
We need it.
Yeah.
Holmes would despise what we've become today.
Oh, he would not recognise the world that we are in right now. No, not at all.
Although he probably would have had a hand with retrieving some missing, stolen government plans about invasions. Actually, no, scratch that. There wasn't any plans.
No plans at all.
No plans at all. All right, so what are you working on next? You must have, I mean, I'm only in the thick of this one.
Yes, once we get this out of the way, very exciting. My company, the Ghostlight League, will be putting on one of our Shakespeare pop culture mashup shows, a part of our trilogy, on at Theatre Works, which is very exciting. Mm-hmm. We're doing our William Shakespeare's Reservoir Dogs. Mm. We are doing that. We did that for our premiere season at the end of 2024.
Yeah.
We got accepted into Theatre Works, so we're going back there for the first time since we did Shakespeare Aliens in 2022, and we're very excited. We're doing a 2-week run from the August 5th of Reservoir Dogs, William Shakespeare's version of it, written by Stephen Hopley. It's a brilliant version. We're so excited to bring it back after about a year and a half.
Well, cry havoc and let slip the Reservoir Dogs of War.
You did your very best Christopher Plummer there as Chang.
No, I've actually covered up my eye patch there. All right, so we're going to have another track here and say farewell to Rob for the day.
Thank you for coming in. Always good to have you.
It's an absolute pleasure. I cannot wait to be back again.
Well, August from the sounds of it.
August, I'll be possibly back in here.
Whole interview in iambic pentameter, no?
You can certainly do that for you if you want.
Oh, stunning.
So good. All right, so we have another track here, which, again, is Sherlockian related. And this is from the Sherlock Holmes the Musical. And this is a track called Sherlock Holmes. And I believe Holmes is in a sticky wicket in this one, where he's being accused of the crime. So Susan Hay is doing the vocals for this one.
I'm Terry Pratchett, the undeservedly famous author of the Discworld novels, so you can believe me when I say that Zero-G on 3RRR is the finest science fiction and fantasy show this side of the Black Stump. I also think Dibbler's delicious pork sausages are the finest eating anywhere in the world, so you know you can trust me on this. Ha 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 ha, with 3 exclamation marks.
Indeed, that was Sarah Hay from the musical about Sherlock Holmes, and that was Sherlock Holmes' reprise.
Well, I think we should ask Rob Lloyd to do a musical version.
I know. I think can we start putting in requests at this point? You know, I feel like we've got a rapport going. Yeah. I feel like, Rob, we should start coming up with some crazy ideas and just pitch them. Why not?
I'd like to do. What's he doing? Shakespeare's Reservoir Dogs.
I mean, we could just pick anything and be like, Rob, make it Shakespeare.
Shakespeare's Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been remiss there. We haven't got to see Hamnet yet.
No. Have you? Yes, no.
Is it a Chloe Zhao film?
Yes, it is.
It is. Chloe Zhao, who has just lost out basically on doing the Buffy reboot.
Yes.
We neglected that last week. We were talking about the Firefly animated show.
Yes, and we did. We meant to drop a mention, but it was sort of still just coming out, the news that, yes, the reboot that was at Hulu was scrapped. Mm. They'd filmed a pilot. It had been talked about and been in development for several years by this point. Sarah Michelle Gellar was on board and, yeah, Chloe Zhao was kind of heading up, directing the first episode, and then Sarah Michelle Gellar took to Instagram with a video that said, I'm sorry to tell everyone that it's no longer going ahead. And then since then, of course, we've got multiple reports out about creative differences, about the tone and direction allegedly of where the pilot was going and, you know, disagreements with the studio versus what Sarah and Chloe wanted to do with the show. So it's yet to be seen whether anything will come of it because obviously the studio still owns the rights to Buffy. They could pursue it in another direction if they wished.
But if anyone deserved a stylish but affordable reboot, that would be Buffy.
Absolutely. And I think that I wouldn't want to see a version that was not something that Sarah Michelle Gellar was involved in and gave her blessing for, at the very least. Yeah. So, yeah, I think for me personally, obviously Buffy's probably got a very close place in my heart, but I would rather not have a reboot than have one that that wasn't, you know, up to par or, you know, took it in a weird direction or was just, you know, not what the fans want. So,
and further to, well, very sad news about the death of Nicholas Brendon.
Yes. And so a lot of people have been taking to Instagram and other channels to express their sort of memories of him and working with him. Obviously, sort of later in life, he had a bit more of a tough struggle. But I think a lot of the his old co-stars and whatnot have come out and said that, yeah, condolences to his family and may he rest in peace now.
And in terms of his work, he had the most difficult job of all, really, playing a non-powered person amongst, you know, the Scooby Gang in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He was Xander.
Yeah.
And that wasn't an easy gig.
No.
But thinking back to how many of the episodes pivoted around something that Xander did or didn't do.
Yeah. It was a very important role to play. And an important, like, in terms of the dynamics of the group as well, you kind of do need some. I mean, he played the heart, the role of the heart in the group.
Mm.
And later on when Dawn came along, I think was very interesting, their connection and the things they bonded over. Dawn obviously also playing sort of a distinct role there, not necessarily being a powered individual. But
he's also in Criminal Minds, was it?
Yes, he was. He was.
I haven't watched that show.
I have, yeah. No, he played, I think he was like a love interest. He was like a computer tech guy.
Of course.
Yeah, and he was a love interest for one of the main characters for a while. And I don't know if he's had many other credits since Buffy and Criminal Minds, though. But he was very young, very sad to hear.
Apparently took up painting as well, which would be nice.
So,
as he says, because it is.
Yeah.
All right, well, very sad in right here.
That's our Buffy update.
Yeah. Now, I was also thinking of another great talent who is no longer with us, James Horner, the composer, US-American composer, born in 1953 and died tragically in a plane crash in 2015. Well, when it comes to genre music score composers from the late 20th and early 21st centuries, the names of three maestros really stand out. You know, I mean, there are many others as well, but the household names, Jerry Goldsmith, John Williams and James Horner, all there for that. And so the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra is part of their Art of the Score program, which we have covered before.
Yes.
On the Hamer Hall on Friday the 27th of March to Sunday the 29th of March. I think there's two shows on the Sunday at least.
One show per day.
One per day. Well, they're doing a special on James Horner. Well over 100 films and TV scores.
Yeah, prolific career.
Hmm. So this will be obviously the MSO. Nicholas Buck is conducting, as we've
had spoken with Nick before, yes.
And again, Andrew Pogson is the presenter. And Dan Golding is a presenter as well. Love his Screen Sounds show on the ABC. And because it's James Horner, they need to have a choir there because, you know, he's known for that. The Australian Girls Choir in there, as well as the requisite singers and so on. And it's got some of my favourite film music there. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, a suite from the Apollo 13 movie, Aliens, just so iconic from the time. The Rocketeer, which is a personal favourite of mine, and one I'd like to actually play a bit from today. And let me see, The Amazing Spider-Man, that's the Andrew Garfield one.
Oh, yeah.
The Mask of Zorro, which is a cracker of a soundtrack.
Gosh, yeah, I forgot about that movie. That was a good one.
Avatar, a suite from that, and Titanic, of course, which gave him his two Oscars in 1998, the Best Music Original Dramatic Score, and also the original song with Will Jennings' help. My Heart Will Go On, of course. I'm not going to play that one today, though.
No, Celine? Come on, Rob.
No, you know me. I actually like that, but it has been kind of played to death.
You've heard it. We've heard it. You know,
It became elevator music, basically.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's not playable. But usually I do like a Klingon version or something like that.
Yes.
Horner was nominated 8 other times for Oscars. Mm-hmm. He got 6 Grammy Awards, 2 Golden Globes and a slew of others. You know, I first heard his work in 1980, I think, with Roger Corman's Battle Beyond the Stars, which has got riffs in it that sort of get cycled into Wrath of Khan later on. But anyway, let's hear, what was I saying, the Rocketeer from 1991, yes, which is an adaptation of the great comic book, of course.
Hi, I'm George Takei, and I play Admiral Sulu in Star Trek. Welcome aboard the Starship Zero-G. Admiral? Hey, a guy can dream, can't he?
That was To the Rescue from the end credits of The Rocketeer, composed by James Horner, of course. And we were speaking of that. We played that, sorry, because we were speaking of the upcoming show at Hamer Hall, which is the MSO playing Art of the Scores James Horner program. And that will be happening this weekend, Friday the 27th of March to Sunday the 29th of March. And you can find details for tickets at the website mso.com.au. And you'll hear a selection of Horner's greatest hits. Yeah. I mean, well, he had a lot of great hits. You'll hear a small selection of some of the iconic scores that he worked on in his many decades prolific career. So,
and I'm looking forward to hearing Dan Golding explaining some of those as well.
Yes, exactly. You'll get a little bit of background and analysis, and always really great informative shows. That one, yes, once again, MSO this weekend, so you can check it out at mso.com.au. And
speaking of Oscar winning?
Yes, speaking of Oscar winners, we're going to roll into Megan's Oscars roundup of the 98th Academy Awards.
Oh, my God.
I know. Something I did see was that there has been a pretty big drop in audience numbers for the live broadcast, but just as much engagement on social channels, news outlets, and so on. So I do think people are still engaging with the Oscars, but maybe just not in real time. So that's fairly interesting, especially given the news that Oscars will be moving the broadcast to YouTube in the year 2029.
Really?
Yes. I mean, that's not necessarily what we're here for, but Oscars is going through a transformation. Obviously, it has a somewhat speckled history. Me and the Oscars, I don't know. I used to love them growing up.
Yeah,
lost
same.
A bit of its shine in the last 5 to 10 years, but anyway, I do always like to see what the Academy has decided to, you know, to give a win or not.
I can remember when the Technical Ones Awards was still incorporated in the same ceremony.
It's not been a while for that, has
bloody
it?
Bloody long trot.
Yeah.
Slog through that.
But we're just going to have a little bit of a look at how genre did on the big night. Mm. So horror as a genre did actually get a bit of its due this year, which was really nice to see.
Huzzah!
Exactly. So from the very beginning, host Conan O'Brien's opening video kind of bit did utilize a weapons reference. And of course, Frankenstein, Weapons, and Sinners were all fairly decent big winners on the night. They were all honoured with nominations in various categories and walked away with trophies as well. So that's really great to see that that kind of genre has – it's sort of unheard of for horror to really be recognised at all in these kind of big award shows, especially the Oscars. Kathy Bates winning for Misery is a notable exception. And, of course, things that are sort of horror or thriller adjacent, like Silence of the Lambs. I mean, Silence of the Lambs was a huge winner in its year. So there are exceptions to this rule, but in general – genre and horror have not been big winners from the Academy, even though sometimes, obviously, they do take a lot of nominations and wins in certain categories like visual effects or special effects. But anyway.
Soundtracks too.
And soundtracks. But let's move into the wins. So both Sinners and Frankenstein did take away trophies in their categories. So Sinners won 4 awards and Frankenstein won 3. And Amy Madigan did take out the Best Actress Award for her performance in Weapons.
And a great performance it is too.
And so I think, you know, I think that one's a bit of an interesting one, but I mean, what an iconic character. And if, you know, the award is going to go to something really memorable that she really kind of just nailed, I think, you know, good on her for taking away that trophy.
There's also, and I'm not saying but, I'm saying also a nostalgia factor in that, because Amy Madigan is a veteran actress and she's done so much great work. And this does sort of feel like a recognition as well.
Yes, I do think, as you know, similar to the Jamie Lee Curtis situation sometimes. And I think, you know, Best Supporting, sorry, you sort of do, she got Best Supporting Actress. Best Supporting is a category where sometimes they do like to give a bit of a legacy lifetime award.
If you're ever going to acknowledge a body of work, then horror is the genre for that.
Exactly, exactly. overall, it was a really great night for Sinners. Despite missing out on Best Picture, it did take some key wins, including Best Actor for Michael B. Jordan and Best Original Screenplay for Ryan Coogler. They're long-time, you know, creative partners. They've worked together on many films. They're great friends. And it was really a good night for both of them.
Surely he deserves two Oscars for the dual role that he plays in Sinners.
You would think. It did seem sort of at the last minute, the buzz right before the ceremony was that Michael B. Jordan was pulling slightly ahead of Timothy Chalamet in the race for Best Actor. And this was sort of after Michael B. Jordan took away the Actor Award, which is sort of considered sort of a bit of a hint towards what will happen at the Oscars. It used to be like the SAG Award.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, Ballet Gate did tarnish a bit of Timothy's shine, even though voting had closed at that stage. But
I sort of peripherally heard something about that.
Yes.
He made some silly crack about
he's a young, silly man. And look, it wasn't great. It was very arrogant comments, but people love to jump on a theme. But look, for me, and I could feel this coming through the broadcast, even the room was really with Michael B. Jordan. Yeah. They were really happy he won. I don't think Timothy would want to win under those circumstances anyway. It would have been awkward for everybody, including him. But Michael B. Jordan did a wonderful performance, and I could tell people were really happy that he got that award.
Well,
like,
deserved.
The audience was on its feet. Also, we know Ludwig Göransson is one of the best composers working today, but the Academy knows it too, and Göransson did walk away with the Oscar for his score for Sinners. Very well deserved. And
just because he also managed to not just encapsulate that period of music as well, but he also brought in he addressed themes of colonization in multiple cultural settings, and I thought that was an amazing thing to do.
He's a really incredible composer. Like, his work is so good. And again, he's another one of Ryan Coogler's kind of creative partners. They've worked together a lot, and they knew each other when they were very young, sort of coming up as well. So it's a really great story, and very well deserved. And also rounding out kind of our little Sinners suite of awards making history, Autumn Girard Acapall was the first woman ever to win Best Cinematography for her work on Sinners. I mean, look, travesty, first woman, but let's celebrate it. I think it's amazing. Obviously, that film looked incredible.
That shot that they did of the multiple eras of music hall sort of stuff, that was just a tour de force.
It was incredible. Just the lighting and the palette of the film, incredible stuff. So moving away from that, we do continue riding the K-wave as K-pop Demon Hunters won Best Animated Feature and Best Original Song. And EJ, Audrey, Nina and Ray Ami performed Golden, the winner of Best Original Song, to a crowd of A-list actors who were all given these light sticks, which is a very common sort of K-pop concert tool. And so they were sort of told to wave them, and you could tell the people that had no idea what to do with that light stick. Like, you could just tell the ones who knew what happened to how you were meant to wave the thing, and then you had other people who kind of just, like Steven Spielberg, was just kind of bobbing it back and forth.
I do hope that Ewan McGregor was there somewhere, or one of the other Star Wars people who've used lightsabers.
He should know what to do with that. Yeah. But that was a really nice, I think, touch for them to give those out, and I thought that was very cool. Lastly, sort of onto some of genre's most favoured categories, Avatar, Fire and Ash did win for Best Visual Effects, and Frankenstein really swept up, taking away awards for Best Production Design, Best Costume Design and Best Makeup and Hairstyling, which you kind of expect from a Del Toro film. They're always kind of big winners in these categories, or should be.
Oh, Demon Hunters won two awards, didn't it?
Yeah, so Best Original Song and Best Animated Feature.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah, very, very well deserved there. As a general comment, sort of just overall, very big night for One Battle After Another, which is a really fabulous film. And poor Marty Supreme took away none of the awards that it was nominated for, which is kind of a very Marty Supreme thing to happen. So, lastly, other notable mentions include Leo's new mustache that's made him hot again. Again, I want to shout out Michael B. Jordan's speech, because truly, like, the reception in the room, it was like old Holly. It made me feel so good. I was like, this is what, someone's been recognized and he seems like a good person and we're happy for him. again, Timothy's gritted teeth during all the ballet and opera jokes. And then there was a bit of a kerfuffle because the poor writer, the winners of the original song for K-pop Demon Hunters, Golden, they did get cut off sort of mid-speech. Very awkward. This happens at award shows, but there was a bit of chatter afterwards because it does always seem to happen to Asian award winners. But overall, very interesting night. Some good news stories came out of it. I think that it was really great that Sinners won big in some of the categories. I really liked One Battle After Another, so I was happy it won as well.
Apart from validating our opinions.
Exactly.
Which doesn't enter into it.
But that is the Oscars roundup. We'll see what happens next year. 99th Academy Awards.
Oh, imagine the 100th one.
Oh, well, it'll be, will that be the one on YouTube? No, but yeah, who knows which way it's going to go. I think Oscars has a speckled history. I think it will continue to
do
so.
Well, you know, we'll be in Trump's third term then, and perhaps Trump will
present
the Oscars.
Don't. Let's play another Hornet.
Speaking of horror.
Yeah, speaking of horror stories. Should we listen to another Horner composition?
James Horner track from Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which is Surprise Attack. And within this track, you'll hear the riffs that sort of represent Ricardo Montalban's Khan, also I think some Enterprise sort of tracks. But Horner managed to really, and it's funny because, of course, Star Trek is Horatio Hornblower, Royal Navy in space. And not only did Nicholas Meyer, the director, nail that in Wrath of Khan, but Horner does in the soundtrack too. It's very, very sort of nautical in space.
I'm David Innes.
And I'm Rob Lloyd. And together we are...
Innes Lloyd. Descend, bold traveller, into the crater of 3RRR.
And there go into the yokum of 0G.
Nothing like being pursued through space ruthlessly by a symphony orchestra there from The Wrath of Khan, Star Trek II, original motion picture soundtrack. Mm. James Horner at the compositional helm there with Surprise Attack.
If you liked the taste of James Horner we just gave you, there you can head along to see Art of the Score, James Horner, happening this weekend at Hamer Hall with MSO. And you can find tickets for that at MSO.com.au. I think that's about it.
Yeah, that's about it for 0G for today. We will go out with some more James Horner classic stuff. This is from one of the themes that I heard first for Horner, along with, you know, Star Trek II and Battle Beyond the Stars and so on. This was from Cocoon in 1985. Ron Howard film, I seem to be thinking.
I think that sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is actually has riffs in it that do that sort of do echo through other Star Trek movies as well. So, yeah, I think it also had, I'm just trying to remember, it had Raquel Welch's daughter in it too. Tawny, I want to say, but I'm not quite sure. All right, so this Cocoon is a fascinating little film. It's about an elderly citizen's home that is visited by aliens who...
Tawny Welsh. Very well done.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've seen that one. And this this has immense regenerative effects upon the citizens of the elderly citizen's home. It's a great science fiction story and hasn't been seen too often on recently on revivals and stuff. So that's why I wanted to play it here instead of like Aliens or any of the other...
Which we turn to quite a bit.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. So, okay, Cocoon from... This is the main theme from the film, James Horner. Until next week, Joe Bernadette coming up next with Astral Glamour. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you, Rob.
G'day, this is Rob Jan. Thanks for listening to the podcast of RRR0G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy and historical. 0G is broadcast live on RRR from Melbourne, Australia every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the RRR website.